Well, you are listening to The Ship Report. We have a special, it's Pledge Drive Week, Membership Drive Week at Coast Community Radio. I'm Joanne Rideout, and we're going to have some special ship reports this week, and today is our first one. And so today, this week, I'm going to be talking to people about their work, their maritime-related work. And our first guest today is a person who you may know if you live in town. This is Astoria's Mayor, Bruce Jones. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning, Joanne.
Thank you so much for being here with us.
Pleasure.
And you are on mic four. Okay, great. Before you became mayor, you have had quite a career in the Coast Guard. And you also, as a helicopter pilot, so I mean, there's so many things we could talk about. We've got 10 minutes. But what I wanted to just ask you about was your work. You had a career in the Coast Guard that is quite amazing, in my opinion. And a great deal of that was that you were a helicopter pilot.
Yeah. Yeah, so I flew for 30 years in the Coast Guard, and then I flew as a helicopter pilot for the Columbia River Bar Pilots for 2.5 years after that. But and I have two sons who are Coast Guard helicopter pilots as well.
Wow.
One's in Michigan and one's in Kodiak, Alaska right now. And it's a very challenging, rewarding, exciting career. And I guess my boys saw that I came home with a smile on my face a lot and decided they would pursue it as well.
Well, so of all the things that you could have done with your life, what drew you to the Coast Guard?
So I was in college. I did a spring semester in Germany, and then I did a junior year of college in Hong Kong. I was majoring in German and East Asian studies. I figured I'd go work for the State Department to be an academic or something. And I got out of college and said, you know, the last thing I want to do is go to graduate school. I kind of want to do something exciting. I always thought about flying. I looked into all five of the military services, kind of narrowed it down to the Navy and the Coast Guard, applied to both, got accepted to both. The Navy had a one-year waiting list, and the Coast Guard took me 2 months later, and I never looked back.
Wow. Well, so I've interviewed people in the Coast Guard before, and you sort of get in there, and you have an opportunity to choose a specialty. So, helicopter pilot just seems like would terrify most people, and the rescuing part of it. So what was it about helicopter flying that got you?
Yeah, so I talked to some Coast Guard pilots about the aviation options within the Coast Guard, fixed wing and rotary wing, and it was clear that helicopters was the hands-on place. If you wanted to just work hard, get sweaty, rescue people, see the smiles on their faces at the end, I mean, flying helicopters is the place to be in the Coast Guard if you're in aviation.
So I've seen the articles in the Daily Astoria, and every once in a while they'll do the Coast Guard does regular training, and people train in the pool all the time here in the Aquatic Center. And there is this thing that I've never seen it, but I've heard about. They take a cage that represents the cockpit of a helicopter, and if you're a trainee, you have to get in it, if I'm understanding correctly, upside down, underwater. And you have to, it's part of your training. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's really important if you're flying helicopters offshore to be able to get out of the helicopter if it crashes. So it's just, and we do that training because there were many crashes in the past in the Navy and Coast Guard where helicopters would enter the water. People would be alive when it entered and flipped upside down and they couldn't get out. And so having that familiarity with how to be in a suddenly completely pitch black environment, upside water coming up your nose, and be able to find your harness release, find a window, get out of the helicopter is really important. So we every 6 years, you go down to one of a few places around the country where they have this huge barrel. It's the 95, they call it. You know, they put you in this barrel, which you're strapped into a seat with windows. They blindfold you. They drop it about 10 feet. It starts to roll left, roll right. You're not sure which way it's going. And then you finally feel the water coming up your shoulder. You take a deep breath, and you have to wait till it's completely upside down. And they're watching you. And they have scuba gear in there. And if you fail, you have to do it again. And when you have the all clear, you with blindfolds on, you find your exit and you find your way out the door and back to the surface. And you have to do it four times, pass each of the four times. And that's every 6 years. And then every year at your home unit here in Astoria, we go to the Aquatic Center. They put you, as you said, into a chair, and it has a harness on it. And again, you have a helmet on and you're blindfolded. They flip you upside down in the chair and you have to release your harness and then work your way through sort of a maze and sometimes they'll block your way and make you go out the opposite direction and you're upside down in the dark. So you get this familiarity with how to get out of a helicopter in the water, which we hope we never have to use, but occasionally people do.
And so that's because the weight of the rotor would tend to flip the helicopter over, is that why?
Yeah,
so it's upside down.
Yeah, once it's in the water, the weight's all up top and you'll flip over pretty quickly.
Wow. Well, so this must be a tremendous sorting thing. It must sort people out really quickly.
Yeah, some people don't like that. I don't know why. I always thought it was kind of exciting.
Oh, my gosh. So I remember there must be a pretty big attrition rate. I remember interviewing a rescue swimmer. 75% of the people who think they want to be a rescue swimmer immediately decide they don't want to after they go into the training. Is it similar for pilots?
No, it's much harder to be a rescue swimmer. That's really tough. That's physically and mentally stressful. So the folks that make it through the rescue swimmer training, that's really tough. So I'd say a higher attrition rate than the going through flight training.
So you were in this role, which is, I would say, primarily you would be called out on rescues. Can you just sort of tell us, like, walk us through an interesting rescue that you went on?
Yeah, so you have a 24-hour shift, and you're there. You go to bed at midnight if nothing's going on, and maybe 2 in the morning you hear this horn go off, kind of wakes you out of your sleep, and it takes you a second, and then you quickly realize, hey, there's something going on. And you'll hear an announcement over the PA system as you're pulling your flight suit and your boots on about, you know, fishing vessel 75 miles off Cape Hatteras taking on water. So you're zipping up and running out to the hangar, and you realize, okay, how far off is it? How much gas do we need? It's a fishing vessel taking on water. You need a couple dewatering pumps. What else do you need? And you just kind of get your crew together. You look at the weather, which you check throughout the day when you're on shift, so you kind of know what it is already. And you make sure you got all the equipment you need, make sure you got your crew, make sure you got enough gas, and you head out there. And then sometimes it's exactly as billed, fishing vessel taken on water. Sometimes it's man overboard. Sometimes it's fishing vessel now on fire. Or maybe the fishing vessel sank an hour ago and you're just looking for strobe lights in the water, hoping to find somebody. So the ability to think quickly on your feet, to adjust the plan, to not have to have guidance, because nobody's there with you. I mean, in the DoD services, if they launch on a rescue mission, and it's probably like 2 or 3 helicopters flying together, supporting each other, we just go out by ourselves. And it's you have to be able to make those adjustments on the fly and respond to the situation.
So that situational awareness thing, that term that I've talked about a number of times on the show, it seems like the paying attention part of it is really important, because most of us can daydream at our jobs. You don't get to do that.
No, not much. I mean, it's rapidly changing environments. You're looking at the weather, you know, your altitude, your airspeed. It gets dark, and then suddenly you're dealing with not being able to see the horizon anymore, and the only thing keeping you from flying into the water at night is you having a good instrument scan. So kind of keeping that situational awareness of where you are relative to the water, to the shoreline, to any obstacles out there, the vessel that you're looking for, and then making an approach to the vessel at night, it's very tricky. In the daytime, you're looking at a ship as you make your approach, and in your peripheral vision, you see the horizon. It kind of keeps your sense of balance and equilibrium. At night, you're just in a pitch black hole. You got a little pinprick of light there, which is the boat you're going to, and you could easily start a descent and never even realize it. So you really have to keep your scan moving constantly on your instruments.
Wow. So then you are, the job of the pilot, so there are 4 people on a crew, a helicopter crew, mm-hmm. Right?
You'll have the pilot, the co-pilot, and either one could be flying at any given time, both trained pilots. You have a hoist operator who's also a mechanic, and then the rescue swimmer.
And so as the pilot's job then is to essentially find the right place to hover over what the rescue situation, right? So do you all talk to each other?
Oh, sure. There's good crew coordination happening all the time. The way you maintain your situational awareness is to take in information constantly. And that information consists of looking at your instruments, of looking at the outside environment, but also listening to the people around you. And so not only as the aircraft commander, you have an obligation to listen to the input from the junior members of the crew. As a junior member of a crew, we beat it into people, metaphorically speaking, figuratively speaking, that it is your obligation to speak up constantly. Don't ever be feel uncomfortable, feel unsafe. As the most junior person on the crew, you have an obligation to speak up immediately, even if it's the commanding officer you're flying with, and let him know if you think he's a little low, you think he's a little too fast.
Wow. So when you mentioned rescuing people and having them be, you know, I would imagine people are extraordinarily grateful. So what is it like when you get out and you get these folks into the helicopter? I mean, they must be just kind of stunned.
Yeah, it's a pretty good feeling at the end of a really tough case that was very difficult to prosecute. You're working really hard. You get a huge sense of relief that we actually got this done and we didn't hurt anybody. And then you look in the back and you see some, you know, cold, wet survivor And they're just glad to be alive. And that's a good feeling. That's why I like flying helicopters.
Well, so we're just about out of time, but how far, what's your range offshore in a helicopter? How far out can you go and still get back?
So the Coast Guard has two different types of helicopters, the H-65 Dolphin, which you occasionally see around here, but they're not stationed here. They're at Coos Bay and Port Angeles. And then you have the H-60 Jayhawk, which we have here in Astoria. And that's got, with if we add the three external fuel tanks, you could go about 3 hours out and 3 hours back at the absolute maximum. So maybe, 400 miles out would be pretty much pushing it to get back.
And so, and you always have to be gauging how much fuel you have left to make sure you can get back.
Oh, that's a huge part of it. The toughest rescue mission I ever did was actually 675 miles offshore off the coast of Cape Henry, Virginia in the Atlantic Ocean. And in order to get 400 miles offshore to rescue these three people, we had to then proceed 275 miles further to Bermuda to land on fumes because there was no way to get back to the coast. And there were no Navy ships around at that time during this big storm to land on. So, yeah, you definitely take fuel into consideration. So you either have to have a ship out there to land on or you have to have enough gas to get back to land.
Wow. Well, thank you so much.
No, it's been a pleasure.
The time just goes by so fast. I'm Joanne Rideout. You've been listening to The Ship Report. My guest today has been Bruce Jones, who is Astoria's mayor right now, but he's talking about his kind of former life as a U.S. Coast Guard helicopter pilot, and you have lots. We'll have to do a Ship Report interview. There's lots more we could talk about.
Great. I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.